So I'm going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to introduce Jamie Nodder. He helps organizations create remarkable cultures anchored in strong employee and customer engagement. He has 20 years of experience in conflict resolution, generational diversity, and organizational development, and has written several books, including the newly released When Millennials Take Over, Preparing for the Ridiculously Optimistic Future of Business. And I'd like to welcome Jamie.
Thank you. Yes, clap, 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 clap. I know, it's a small group. So I am going to talk about millennials today. I'm going to talk about some of the research we did for in our book. But this is a small group. So if you have specific questions, you want me to go in specific directions, that's what we're going to do. Okay? You don't just have to sit there passively the whole time. Are okay with this? All right. And I'm actually supposed to talk into the mic since this is being recorded, but I tend to wander, so we'll see how that goes. So I want to talk about millennials. This has been a question that has been reverberating around the business world for about 10 years. A question that we're not finding the answer to right away, that we're struggling with. A question you may have asked in your organization or in your business life in the last 10 years, and that's basically what do we do with the millennials? Like, what do we do about them? This conversation has been going on for 10 years, and a piece of the conversation has been rooted in frustration that the older generation has with millennials. Okay, a lot of this talk you hear about millennials is that we're frustrated because they're entitled. Have you heard this one about millennials? They're entitled. They show up at work, and after 2 minutes, they want a promotion. There's a lot of conversation about how they're inappropriate. The older generation seem to be really obsessed with the millennials' fondness for flip-flops. Okay, lots of conversations about their flip-flops. It drives the older generation crazy. But I read an article in the research for the book of a recruiter who was hiring for a position, and it was an entry-level position, so he was interviewing a millennial, goes out into the waiting room to get the millennial for the job interview. The millennial's not there by himself. Anyone guess who the millennial brought with him? His mom. Now again, the older generations freak out about stuff like this. And the guy, the recruiter in the article was like, doesn't that guy realize how inappropriate that is? You don't do that. Now, I will say, this is sort of off topic, but there was a survey of millennials and apparently 8% had brought a parent to a job interview. So I don't know how odd that is, even though it seems odd to the older generation. And to be honest, this conversation has been really negative that we've been having about millennials, about how they're inappropriate, how they don't get it, how they don't understand. And there are a lot of millennials now that don't want to be called millennials. They're like, really, I don't want to be associated with that. What's interesting, though, is that we have this conversation about how negative or how inappropriate or entitled they are. And then, like, 2 minutes later, we're falling all over ourselves to recruit them, to retain them, to get them as customers. I spoke at a direct marketing association conference, and the marketing people, like I talked about millennials. I said, are there any questions? And this one woman asked a question, and she was almost desperate. Like, how do we get them to listen to our messages? And I'm like, well, first of all, stop trying to get them to listen to your messages and start saying things that are worth sharing. We want to attract millennials, to bring them in, to recruit them, to retain those employees. And part of this is based on their size as a generation. Okay, they are the largest generation in the history of the United States. Okay, by far. We used to talk a lot about the boomers and how large generation they were, and they are a large generation. They were named after the baby boom, right? So you'd expect this to be a large generation. But still, by most counts, and how you count, there's a whole theory behind it, which I won't get into, but a lot of people put the baby boomers at about 75 million people. Today, right now, there's 100 million millennials. Okay, and so they're not even yet the largest segment of the workforce, but they will be soon. And they're certainly not the largest segment of the consumer base yet, and many of them are young still, obviously. But they will be. They will be the largest segment of the workforce, they will be the largest segment of the consumer base, and they will hold that spot for decades because they're so huge. So that's why a lot of us are saying, okay, how do we get the millennials? How do we attract them? And but both approaches, the sort of complaining about millennials because they're entitled and falling all over ourselves about millennials to attract them, have not really been answering this question of what do we do? How do we engage properly with this generation? And so I think it's really important that we change the conversation that we're having. Change it from all these conversations we're having about where we talk about the millennials and start talking with them. And in that vein, actually, it's a small group, but I like, every time I talk about millennials, I want to know which generations I have in the room today, which then makes people nervous because they think I'm going to ask them how old they are, and I know I'm not supposed to do that. So can we, even the small group, we're going to play a little game. We're going to play the, do you remember where you were when a certain historical event happened? So no one's going to admit how old they are. We're just going to play a little game. You with me on this one? All right, who remembers where they were when basically anything in World War II happened, like the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, Pearl Harbor, anybody? Okay. I have yet to get a hand on this one, but if we did get a hand, this would be the silent generation. Okay, the silent generation is still in the workforce. They're probably getting under 1% now of the workforce, but they do exist in the workforce, but obviously they're shrinking, retiring, and not so much anymore. But now I'm going to get some hands. Who remembers where they were when Kennedy was shot? All right, look around the room. These are your baby boomers. Again, this is not an exact science the way I'm doing this, but at least I'm not asking people all there. So that's the baby boom generation. Again, has been a very dominant generation politically, culturally, and in organizations too for the last several decades. And by the way, boomers, once you raise your hand once in this game, you're done. I get it, you're going to remember. You like to play, I get it, and you like to participate. You don't get to raise your hand anymore. I know you'll remember anything else I say after this one. Okay. So if you haven't raised your hand, who remembers where they were when the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded, 86? Okay, that's Generation X. Okay. And again, my audiences tend to be boomers and Xers. Boomers and Xers have been the overwhelmingly largest segment together of the workforce for a long time. A lot of the generational stuff has been about boomer versus X conflict, because they view things differently. And then finally, if you haven't raised your hand, how many people think all of those were interesting historical events, but you read about them on Wikipedia or some other source? Yes, we get a couple of hands. Raise them high, millennials, come on.
Those are millennials.
But this is what happens. This is what happens in almost all of my conversations. I get people who want to answer that question of what do we do about the millennials, and I don't get a lot of millennials in the room. And we need to start shifting that. If you want to figure out what to do about millennials, you need to start talking with them and not talking at them. And that means figuring out ways to get them in the sessions that you're at, get them to the conferences you're at, get them in the meetings that you're at, because we're not doing that enough. And so the first step, once you get them in the room, well, but even before you get the room, one thing that I'll talk about today is if you really want to understand the millennial generation, you have to understand what shaped them. Because we know this about baby boomers. We know this about Generation X. Baby boomers grew up and came of age in the 60s, like as a generation. That's what shaped them. It was a very idealistic, revolutionary time. So you've got a generation that's very group-focused, very team-focused, very cause-focused, hard work. You show up and you put in the hours. Like that's sort of the baby boomer kind of approach. In the workplace. Generation X grew up in a very different time. First wave of major corporate downsizing in the history of the United States happened when Gen X was growing up. Three Mile Island, the oil crisis. There was a lot of that was happening, like huge skyrocketing divorce rates. We were the latchkey kids. This is me. Can you tell I'm talking more about this? We were the latchkey kids, right? We sort of came home by ourselves and did our own thing. That created a generation that was very different than the boomers, much more independent, very cynical, like a little bit of, you know, I was promised one thing but then delivered another. So from now on, if you promise me something, maybe I'll believe it, maybe I won't. Let me see the results first, and then I'll be the judge of that. So sort of a cynical, independent, less team and group focused in the workplace anyway, generation. And we know this because we can look back historically. But what we're not doing is having that conversation about millennials, like what did they grow up with and how did that shape them? Because that actually explains a lot of the behavior that older generations find puzzling about them. All right? So I want to talk about four trends that shaped the generation so that we can understand what this means for having them in our workplace and as consumers in the business world, okay? And again, you guys have to interrupt with questions, you promise? You're not going to just sit there the whole time? You might. It's early in the morning. Okay. The first trend is the social internet, which should be a surprise to no one. Okay? But this is arguably having the biggest impact on this generation. The millennials grew up with the internet. So I got mostly boomers and Xers in the room. So tell me if you resonate with this, because like, and I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but like, I still think it's kind of cool when I go on Google and search something, right? You put in the search, and first of all, now it knows what I'm searching before I'm done typing it, which blows me away. But then you get the results, and it's like there are 9 million, you know, results in 0.001 seconds, and they're all perfect. Like, how amazing is that? Like, I still think that's amazing. So here's the deal. Millennials don't think that's amazing. That's just normal. Like, why wouldn't you have access to all that information? They've always had access to all of that information their whole lives. It doesn't, like, making a long-distance phone call is not amazing to you guys, right? I wouldn't be blown away by the fact that I can call California and talk to them. No, because we grew up with that. It was normal. It was not amazing. To older generations, that's pretty amazing. So the millennials do not get blown away by the internet. That is just normal. And it's not just the internet that shaped them. It's the social internet. They had access growing up to an incredibly broad and rich and deep social network growing up. So if you needed to solve a problem, you could reach out to your network and solve it. Okay. What we don't realize, I think, about the internet is that it's been a huge shift in the balance of power. Power used to exist in centralized institutions. If you wanted to entertain a large group of people, you needed a television studio and a big antenna, and you would broadcast it out. Now you can use the internet and do that on your own. Okay? And like this, the network, like if you have a digital camera, if you're a millennial and you've got a digital camera and it doesn't do what you want it to do, you just announce that on your social network, and somebody will know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody in Hungary who's written some code that you can put on a flash drive and stick in your camera, and now your camera does something that the manufacturer did not intend for it to do. Like, that is incredibly powerful. Previous generations did not have access to that kind of power, where I could solve a problem like that on my own, using my network without going through the powers that be. We, previous older generations, we couldn't do that. That power changes things. So when the millennials show up at work, in general, this is broad, your mileage may vary, your millennials in your office may be different than this generalization, but when they show up at work, they want to do things themselves. Because they always have been able to. You give them that power growing up, they're going to show up in the workplace, they're going to do things themselves, they're going to take action, they're going to want to meet, they're going to move things, they're going to do stuff, and we put them in entry-level positions and say, that's exactly what you can't do. You can only do what we tell you to do, what your job description says. That doesn't make sense to them. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, I'm just saying it doesn't make sense. The second trend is abundance. Okay, so the millennial generation in this country grew up with unparalleled abundance. Now, to some extent, every generation has a little bit better than the one before, at least according to the one before that's complaining about having to walk to school both hills, you know, uphill both ways and all that kind of stuff. But it's true. The standard of living's been going up. But in the millennial generation, it's been spiking. They grew up, so here's some statistics, just to give you a sense of the abundance that we have in this country. The United States spends more on trash bags than 90 other countries spend on everything. There are more automobiles in this country than there are licensed drivers. I guess if you have a driver's license, there's 1-point-something cars out there for you. There's more than one. And my favorite statistic on the abundance is from the self-storage industry. Can anyone guess how much we spend on self-storage in this country? $24 billion a year. $24 billion to build little houses for our stuff that we couldn't fit into our houses. And our houses are on average larger than they ever have been. Our living spaces are bigger. Okay? This self-storage industry is an industry that did not exist during the Great Depression. We didn't have that problem back then of having so much stuff that we don't know what to do with, that we have to build these stuff houses. This is abundance. And so part of the abundance actually is also just the social, like the internet. Like, that's an abundance of information. They grow up with access to everything. And they grow up in a world where there are more resources. Now, I'm very clear that abundance is not evenly distributed in this country. And so, and particularly, I get pushback from millennials when I talk about abundance. Because they're like, abundance? Are you kidding? I just got out of school. I got like $9 trillion in student loans. I try and get a job, and then they tell me I have to go get a master's degree, and I'm living at home still. Like, it doesn't feel very abundant. But I just want to point out, like, that's a life stage thing. Like, it's never really that abundant when you're in your 20s. That's when you eat ramen, okay, to survive. Like, that's, I get it. So it doesn't feel abundant, but as a generation, they grew up with more abundance than previous generations, which means they show up in the workplace expecting resources to be available. They expect the technology to work. They expect to have equipment that works. They expect there to be more than previous generations have. Okay, and so that's showing up. But again, they grew up with it, and so they're sort of responding naturally to what they grew up with. The third trend is diversity. The millennial generation in this country grew up with more diversity, and I think part of that is just the visible diversity we see in society. That's been changing, again, over multiple generations, but has really skyrocketed in the last 10 or 20 years as the millennials were growing up. I remember going to a session in D.C. It was a political thing. I forget what this woman's title was. But she worked for the State Department. And she was fairly high up. And she was with her millennial daughter in the kitchen and watching something on TV. I think it was when John Kerry was being sworn in as Secretary of State. And I forget how old her daughter was, preteen, but old enough to be aware of some of the political stuff, although in D.C. we're more aware maybe than other places. But the daughter said, "Wow, a man can be Secretary of State?" Because this kid had grown up with only women secretaries of state. Like, it was just sort of interesting. Like, that's a really different than it used to be in previous generations. There's more. Even my kids, they recognize that when we elected Obama president, like, they study the history books. They know that that was the first time we had a non-white person as president. Like, that's a significant event. But they still had this reaction of, like whatever. Like, why? What's the big deal? And so there's more diversity, there's more expectation of diversity, but it's not just race and gender and ethnicity. It's the idea of the mashup. It's the idea that when you design something for one purpose, of course I'm going to take that and experiment with it and use it in another way. I'm going to take music from one genre and I'm going to apply it over here. I'm going to take this particular tool and I'm going to use it in this way that it wasn't designed for and see what happens. Even something like Twitter. Twitter was designed to send text messages to people in one organization. And they evolved it. They worked with it. They brought in other influences. And it became this huge mass communication tool that's now supporting revolution around the world. So, like, this kind of diversity and innovation and change is, like, the norm for this generation. They expect it, and they come into organizations and they say, "Wow, I was next door in the marketing department and they use this process. This is cool. Let's use this in our department." And they get the, whoa, we can't. That's what they use. We can't do that here. We have a different process here. Like, it's, well, why do we do it this way? Why do we still use this technology when it doesn't make sense? And, well, that's how we've always done it. Like, that doesn't make sense to them. They expect diversity. They expect change. They expect innovation. Because they grew up with it. And the last trend, which I hear a lot about when we talk about millennials, is the elevated status of children, which this, by the way, gets into the everyone gets a trophy thing, which the older generation is very upset about, because we only got trophies when we won the division. No, oh, sorry, I don't mean to get mad about that. The millennial generation grew up with... because this gets framed as they were spoiled or they got too much attention. But the bottom line is a huge difference with the millennial generation is when they were growing up, the parents were down at their level more frequently. Okay? Like, that's it. Like, in the first millennials were born in 1982. You know what was introduced in 1982 as a product? The Dodge Caravan. Like, the minivan was invented in the same year the millennials were born. Not a coincidence. Like, we started creating vehicles for parents. We didn't do that before. Like, and so, and that's also the baby on board signs, the little yellow, that's about the same era. We started focusing on children more. Gen X grew up by themselves. Millennials grew up with parents that with them. So, like, again, mostly Gen X and Boomer audience. When we were growing up, if our parents had a cocktail party in the neighborhood, and all the kids and all the adults were together in the house and in the kitchen, the adults would be talking about grown-up stuff. They'd be talking about work, they'd be talking about politics. We wouldn't understand it as kids, and we get bored and we go away and play. Today, I'm guilty of this. I'm now having a cocktail party. I got my millennial children in the room. What's going on? First of all, the parents are talking to the children at the party on a first-name basis. Okay, that didn't happen as much before. And even after the kids get bored and go away, what are the parents talking about? They're talking about the kids, they're talking about the schools, they're talking about carpool, they're talking about that ref at the soccer game. And the kids hear this. The kids hear their parents constantly talking about their world, constantly being in their world, constantly driving them places and scheduling things for them. It means when they show up at the workplace, they expect hierarchy lines to be blurred. Like, a millennial will have no problem stopping the senior global VP of blah, blah, blah in the hall to ask her a question. And everyone else, all the Xers and boomers around, are like, what are you doing? You can't do that. You have to go to the scheduler and get on the calendar. And, like, that's what you do, right? But they wouldn't occur to them because they had people, basically, who were higher in the hierarchy, adults, right? They're more powerful than children, and everyone knows that. The children know that. The adults know that. But they had that higher hierarchy down at their level more frequently. They had access. They had access to people up the chain as kids. And so they go into the workplace, and they expect the same kind of thing. Questions about any of this? Does this make sense? You think I'm just, well, I am just making it up, but is it, I mean, you know, this is big picture stuff, but what do you think?
Interesting.
You guys are a quiet group. Okay. It's early, isn't it? Yeah, we're good. So I guess part of the argument I'm making is we need to be a little more curious about the millennials and understand what shaped them so that we can have better conversations with them about moving forward. But I also still, even when I talk about this, get pushback that says, okay, I get it. Here's the millennials. Here's what shaped them. But why still do we need to focus so much on the millennials? Like, why? Like, do we have to just do whatever they say? Is this like, did we do this with the boomers and the Xers? No, we sort of let them sort of evolve organically. Why are we paying attention to the millennials? And the short answer to this, I won't go into detail, though there's more detail in the book. The short answer is the millennials actually just happen to be at the right place at the right time. And this is even bigger picture than a single generation. This is I won't go into the theory too much on this, but there's a pattern in this country that every four generations, there's a huge transition. Which I did not realize until I read a book that I read recently called The Fourth Turning. And unfortunately, perhaps, it's a major transition accompanied by a big war as well. Okay, so you even go back to the Revolutionary War, 1770s. If you go four generations forward from that, and a generation's roughly 20 years, it's not exactly, but it's roughly 20 years, so you're looking at 80 to 100 years after the Revolutionary War, guess where you end up? Civil War, 67 years later, right? So you go four generations after the Civil War, where do you end up? World War II. And these are not just big wars, which they were huge societal transitions. It was a big shift to go from our colonial era to the first era when we were a nation. It was a big shift to go from pre-slavery, post-slavery, beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And it was a big shift in World War II. We sort of went from the pre-modern era to the modern era. Okay, so guess where you end up if you go four generations after World War II? Right now. This is it. So I'm a little nervous, actually, about the whole war thing. And let's hope that we've figured that one out and we're going to change that pattern and there's not going to be a big war. But I do think there is going to be a big transition. And we are ripe for a transition. And each time there's a transition, there's a one particular generation that leads it. The generation that led the transition in World War II was called the GI generation. This is the one we call the greatest generation. Okay, and there were generations, the people who study generations will identify the specific generations that led the transition in the Civil War and that led the transition in the Revolutionary War. Like, just happens to be. And those generations, honestly, are not better or worse than any other. They're just in the right place in the right time. And they happen to be shining a light on the direction that we're going to move in for the next 100 years. And that's what the millennials are doing. They're just responding naturally to what they grew up with. But they happen to be shining a light on the direction we're going to be heading in, particularly when it comes to leadership and management in organizations. We invented management 100 years ago, and we haven't changed it much. And the millennials are not like having all the brilliant answers, but they are shining that light on where we are going, this direction we're moving in. And the organizations that figure that out are going to start to succeed wildly. And we're all going to wonder, like, why are these new organizations that are doing it differently succeeding so much? It's because they're aligning themselves with these changes that are happening. That's my argument. That's sort of the argument that we make in the book. And we actually did research on this. So I've been studying generations for more than a decade. And so I understand the millennial approach. And I just went over sort of what was shaping them and how they're showing up in the workplace, wanting sort of more, you know, less blurred hierarchy lines and being able to do things themselves and more innovation and diversity, that kind of stuff. We know that. We don't just have to copy them. We don't just have to do what they say. I wanted to look at where's the overlap between their approach and organizations that have really, really strong cultures. Organizations that are running circles around their competitors. And I found them. We found them in the research. And they're amazing organizations. And they're not, I intentionally didn't find or didn't do research on like Zappos and you know, Amazon, and like the ones that get all the attention and get written about, and you know, Google. Because if I do that, you'll say, yeah, but I'm not Google, so that doesn't help. I found small organizations, I found a nonprofit. I'm going to talk about each four of them in a minute. But they have strong cultures. These are organizations that, they have 100% employee engagement. Do you guys measure employee engagement in your organizations? Do you even think about that? Like, how engaged are your employees? Nationwide, you know what the number is? 30%. 30% of employees are considered engaged at work. 20% are so disengaged, they're actively sabotaging their own workplace. Like, that's what the numbers say, which is scary. But these organizations, I found they had 100% engagement. Their employees are saying things like, I can't imagine working anywhere. I remember when I used to work for XYZ organization, I'm never going back to that again. These are organizations that charge more than their competitors and still have clients lining up because their stuff is that good. Okay? These are organizations that win the Best Place to Work award. Right? You've seen those. They win it so much. One of them won it so many times, they asked them to stop applying because they wanted other people to get a chance to win. Right? They created a special category for them. I think they call them emeritus or something, so that they can still enter the contest, but they're not going to compare them with everyone else. They're that good. I wanted to find organizations that are that good because, again, I think that the millennials are shining a light on a new way, so I wanted to find the organizations that were already doing that. And when I looked at those organizations, and I looked at the millennial approach, I found four capacities that these organizations were developing that also are aligned with the millennial way of looking at things. And so again, it's not that you have to do whatever the millennials do, but I want you to pay attention to what the organizations that are running circles around their competitors are doing. And the fact that it lines up with the millennial approach, to me, says maybe this is what we need to do. All right, so I'll talk about each one. The first one is digital. Again, I'm hoping this one's not a surprise to you, but the digital capacity inside organizations, at one level, this means using technology, okay? So, like, I really hope that you guys are at least on the front end of the technology use curve. Like, are people still mostly typewriters? Anybody? No. You're using computers, yes. Are we doing a little social media? We're figuring social media out. We're sort of anyone working with online communities with their customers, or no, that's a little front end. So there are people that are sort of maybe a little ahead of you guys. That's fine, but you've got to be on the front end of the digital technology adoption curve. You need to invest in technology. You need to create an organization that survives in the digital age. But this one's not so much about technology as it is about a mindset. And the digital mindset has three components. One, it's got a disciplined and very intense focus on the user. Like, think about this if you're a software designer. You design software in today's environment, it has to be totally focused on user experience. Like, if it's not a good user experience, they're going to throw it away and go get another app. Like, they're not going to wait. So the designers, and of course that's really annoying for the designers, because they have to design their software to work on 27 different platforms and 112 different devices. Like, and it's got to be mobile, and it's got to be on the PC. Like, it's really hard to make software work like that, but that's the work you do now. You make it work for the user. And the user, in an organization's case, is the customer, but it's also the employee. What I found about digital organizations that have this capacity is they design their organization around the needs of the employees, not the needs of the management. Okay? So the case study we found for this is a small nonprofit called the American Society for Surgery of the Hand. They're only 22 people, but they designed their entire office space around the needs of the employees. Like, they bought a building and they had to build out their space, and so they created lots of different ways for people to work. They've got Wi-Fi on the work. On the roof, even though they're in Chicago. Like, what were they thinking? Like, they can use that like 3 months out of the year? I don't know. It's going to be cold there. So they got Wi-Fi on the roof. They have an open space where everyone has desks. Their desks raise and lower automatically with the push of a button. All of their employees get a new laptop and a new tablet every 2 years because you have to have the technology that works. They had no problem scrapping their entire organizational database and putting in a new one, even though that was disruptive, because the old one was not letting the members, in this case, and the customers access information the way they needed to, so they spent the money and they did it. They've got a yoga room, they've got a little coffee area, they've got couches by the front that the marketing team has commandeered, and that's where they do all their work. And they put their CEO and all their senior managers out in the open space with everybody. Nobody has an office. And there's a lot of literature about the open office movement and like that's the wave of the future. I don't think it is. I don't think that's the point. They put their CEO out there because the employees found that when they had access to the senior management, they got more work done and they got better work done. If it works for the employees, that's what they do. And this is the organization that has that 100% engagement. This is an organization that accomplishes more than peer organizations its size because the people are so engaged and working so hard, they do amazing things. They put all of their content that they've ever developed in the association online in a period of 18 months. I work a lot in associations. There's no association I've met besides them that could accomplish that. And they did it because they have this engagement because they designed the organization around the needs of the user. It's a huge mental shift, mindset shift in an organization, but they get tremendous results from that. You are supposed to interrupt me with questions, right? I didn't say that before.
What's the name of that company?
It's the American Society for Surgery of the Hand. So they're an association that represents hand surgeons. And that's an organization where their members are all hand surgeons. It's not just hand and extremities, I think. Anyway, they're hand surgeons. They're all members of the American College of Surgeons. Like, that's their big association. And they're all members of that. But they volunteer through Surgery of the Hand because it's so much more fulfilling for them. So the smaller group, the smaller specialty society, gets more attention, more volunteer engagement than the bigger one because they've embraced this mindset. So the first capacity is digital. The second one is clear. Oh, yes, go ahead.
I have a question. On one of your previous slides, you said that the millennials, there's an elevated status of children. And what I hear parents saying all the time is, my kids are so entitled. If you don't give them what they want, they can't do anything. So how do you connect that with future leaders? You know, there's a disconnect for me there. I don't know.
Well, I mean, so to me, it's well, there's two things. One is just an acknowledgement that we, as so the millennials, have parents that are a mix of boomers and X. Like the generations don't just go one to one to one. It always mixes like that. So they have a mix of boomer parents and X parents, which is great because that's what we got in the room, all boomers and Xers. So can we all please admit that as much as we don't like this entitlement mindset from the millennials, that we created it? We did this. We gave the millennials everything. Yeah. We gave them what they wanted. We negotiated with them at dinner. We treated them like adults, honestly, when they were little kids in a lot of ways. We drove them places. We scheduled things for them. We provide, and on top of that, they had the internet. Like when they couldn't get it from us, they could get it from the internet. And so this is a generation, like this idea of being entitled means it is owed to me. But I don't think the millennial perspective is coming from this is owed to me. It's coming from I've always had it. Why don't I have it now? Yes. Why are you suddenly telling me that I'm not going to get something that I got before? Any generation would respond in the same way. Okay, so to answer your question from a leadership point of view, I don't think it's coming from a sense of it's owed to me and I'm just going to stand back and let it happen. I think it's coming from, and so I don't think from a leadership perspective, once they realize that it's not going to come, they're actually going to organize and reach out to their networks and make it happen. There are more 11-year-old business owners in the millennial generation than in any previous generation. Okay? So this idea that they are going to be incapable is generationally speaking, not as valid as it is as the individual experience, which is sometimes your kid is there or your new employee is there and they're complaining and not working and not doing it. Like that happens, but that happens in every generation. Broadly speaking, I think the millennials are actually more empowered to get things done and to lead collectively than previous generations, which is where I think we're headed as well. There's going to be more collective leadership, which we'll talk about in a minute as well. Yeah.
When you're talking about entitlement, you're not just talking about money or, giving me everything I want. Aren't you talking more about information, access to information, and the ability to get things done the way that they are comfortable getting things done, as
yes.
opposed to what we would consider the norm?
Yes, because they've been able to customize their experience. That's the other piece of the digital mindset. One is designing around your users. The second element is customization. Everything's been. What is the first thing you do when you get any kind of piece of equipment or software? You go to the settings and you customize. You make it work for me. And then constant improvement and innovation. Constant improvement and innovation. The surgery of the hand does new job descriptions every year for every individual, and each one is customized based on the career path of that particular individual. So you can have two people with a similar job, very different job descriptions, because they're in different places in their career and they're going in different directions. And you think to yourself, wow, that's hard. That's hard work on the organization to create all those job descriptions. And the answer is yes, it is hard work on the organization, and you get the kind of results that they get when you do that work. That's the ROI of that. And it's a different mindset because we grew up saying you don't spend that kind of time on your employees, not until they've proven their worth. And here's an organization that says, you know what, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to invest in them right now. I'm going to customize for them right now. And they get that kind of engagement that we have not seen in organizations. We're just not used to it. We assume that basically you get 30% engagement and that's about all you're going to get. And that there's no rule that says it has to be that way. And not just digital, not just society's surgery of the hand. All of the other four case studies that we looked at have that kind of engagement. Not just from the digital mindset, but the other things as well. This is the revolution, which is there is another way of managing inside organizations that we haven't tapped into that's going to release a lot of power that we haven't been getting. Yeah.
So we have to shift our mindset. It's not entitlement. There's another word for it. And I think entitlement is almost derogatory, right?
Yes. Entitlement says the world owes this to me.
Right.
I'm entitled. And that, and so this is sort of like self-help 101. Like, the world owes you nothing. When you realize that, then it's like, oh, then I actually just have to decide what I'm going to do and get things done and move forward.
And they do that.
And they do that. And so I, the entitled thing, and I, listen, I understand that there are young people that, like, you see this sort of skits on Saturday Night Live, you know, and they have the skit called the Millennials, right? And they have some guy with a phone, like, can I have a promotion? And the manager's like busy, right? He's like, what? What? It's like, yeah, can I have a promotion? And he's like, didn't you start yesterday? You know? It's like, yeah, but I really need a new iPhone. You know, it's like, it's comedy, okay? It's farce. And it's rooted in this making fun of the other generation, which is a problem, which we've done every 20 years since the dawn of time. We always do this. And there are individuals like that. There are individuals who expect more than they should in a given situation. My point is, that's true in every generation. And what we're reacting to is a generation that is not necessarily entitled, but has much higher expectations. They are raising the bar. And it's because of the abundance, and it's because of the social internet, it's because of what they grew up with. We gave them more, and so they're raising the bar on us. And so we don't like that, and we have old systems and old models inside organizations that don't react well to that. But when you make the shift, then it's a little bit easier. So the second capacity that we found in our research was clear. Okay, and this one is about transparency. This is about making things visible. The organization that we found as a case study for this is actually a software company. It's called Menlo Innovations. They're in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They got about 50 people. They do custom software design. So if you need some sort of software to run like your university or something, you don't just go buy that off the shelf. You got to get a custom package designed and delivered for you. That's what they do. They make things very clear, and the point about transparency, because transparency has been in the business literature for a while now, and it gets a little bit of pushback, like, oh, I'm not sure I should share information, or maybe release it on a need-to-know basis, but it's not about being transparent for transparency's sake. It's about making things visible in order to increase the quality of your decisions internally. The more information that is available, the better decisions get made. And I'll tell you a little story, and you guys can look this up. There's a really good TED Talk by a guy named Stanley McChrystal. He's retired now, but he was a former general. And have you seen the TED Talk? It's amazing. So he was head of, I forget the exact title, so I'm going to put it in layman's term. He was head of the super secret agent spies. Okay, the military intelligence divisions in Iraq right after the fall of Baghdad. And his job was to get rid of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So here he is in a war-torn society with this distributed network of terrorists infiltrated throughout the entire system. He's got to get rid of them, and he's in charge of military intelligence and the spies and the secret agent stuff. When he got there, the first year he was there, they were running 18 intelligence operations a month, which was considered to be pretty fast. And he said, we are never going to make a dent in this insurgency at that rate. We have to speed this up. So what he did is when he found intelligence, when his unit found intelligence, he declassified it and shared it with everybody. And he got in huge trouble from the higher-ups, because that's not what you're supposed to do. It's like, he made a joke once. He's like, they found some personnel records from an enemy cell, and they made it, they declassified it and shared it. And someone's like, but what if the enemy gets their hands on this? He's like, well, it's the enemy's records, so I don't think this is a problem. But he shared it, and that was really hard for that system to understand, because they are spies. Information is power. You don't share it with anybody, even with each other. They didn't do that, but he He declassified it. He made it transparent. He put all the information out there. They went from doing 18 operations a month to doing 300 operations a month. They would do 10 operations a night. And by the 10th operation, they're working on intelligence that they didn't even know existed when they started that night. Okay? But they only got that when they released the information. McChrystal said, I can't do this on a need-to-know basis because I can't know who needs to know. Not in today's complex, fast-moving environment. I can't predict who needs to know, so I need to give it to everybody and let the people who do need it make decisions based on it when the decision is needed to be made. Okay, that's what Menlo Innovations does. They share all their information. They put all of their project management system up on a wall. They got 50 people all working together. Oh, by the way, I love this. They use a thing called paired programming. Have you heard of this? In the software world. So they're writing code, and they have two people per one computer. So like you share a keyboard and a mouse and a screen with your partner as you write the software, which means as I'm typing the code, my partner is reading it and commenting on it to me as I'm typing it. Like, I don't even have the opportunity to go in a room, make my code, perfect it, and then share it and get feedback. I'm getting feedback as it's coming out of my head. And you think, oh, that must be distracting. The truth is, it reduces the number of errors dramatically. Because by making it visible as it's coming out of my head and getting feedback on it together, we make better decisions on how to code. They make fewer errors and they spend less time fixing bugs later. So it's more efficient. This is the organization that charges more than their competitors. And still has clients lining up because they deliver a product that is that much better. Okay? They put all of their project management system on the wall, which means, and I thought they'd use a fancy computer system for this, they're software designers, but in fact they put paper on the wall that shows what each pair is working on and whether they're done and whether they're not done. They use little sticky dots to say where they are. And as they put it up there, that means everybody in the room that's all working together, they can look up at the board, they can see who's ahead, who's behind, and they make their own decisions about when to stop their own work and when to go help somebody else. And so the system becomes much faster, the system makes better decisions, and it didn't require managers, it didn't require a boring project status update meeting, it didn't even require email. When they want to solve problems together, they actually talk to each other in the room. Okay? And so because they make it visible, because they work together in the same room, because they put it all up there, better decisions get made. That's the essence of CLEAR. And that's what we need to build into organizations. This is not the traditional way of doing it. Traditionally, we divide things into departments, and then we don't share. I mean, I talked to one organization. They were on multiple floors in a building. And, you know, you have to have the little card to get into the office, right, for security. But your card will only get you to your floor. So, like, if you need to talk to marketing, like, you'll be in the stairwell, like, looking through the window, like, hello, will you let me in? Like, you can't even get in. Talk about silos in organizations. You can't even get in to talk to people. We build organizations that have these departments, these areas of expertise. And then we are sort of annoyed when we have to collaborate. We're annoyed when we have to share information across those lines because we know what we're doing and they wouldn't know what to do with the information anyway. That system doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to millennials. And it's not as productive. It's not as effective. All right. Number three is fluid. Fluid is about hierarchy. Fluid is about and not getting rid of hierarchy. By the way, you never really get rid of hierarchy. Hierarchy is a natural thing. Fluid is about making a hierarchy more flexible. So the case study in this case was an organization called QLI. They're a healthcare company in Omaha, Nebraska. And they have a hierarchical system. They have a hierarchy. They got a president. They got a CEO. They got VPs. They have directors. Like, it's a traditional structure. But when they're doing their work, and you have to understand what they do. They provide rehabilitation services to people with brain injuries and spinal cord injuries. So this is really hard work. And they will say it themselves. They're not just doing healthcare. They're rebuilding shattered lives. Right? They're teaching people how to walk again, how to eat again, how to talk again. Like, this is really, really hard work. And they know that when they do their work, they're doing speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy. It only works when they connect what they're doing to the patient's hopes and dreams and aspirations and things that have deep meaning. Because that's the deal. If you're rebuilding a shattered life, you have to connect your work to something that means something. So when they do that, this is how they change, they make their hierarchy flexible. They have a rule in this organization that if you are the one that knows the most about the patient and their hopes and their dreams and their aspirations, you get to decide. And so they had a meeting once where it was like, there were two brand new interns at this meeting. It was their first day. And they were discussing what to do about a particular patient. And the CEO was in the room. Like only 10 people in this meeting. The CEO was one of them. And the two interns who had never met the CEO did not know that the CEO was in the room. I mean, think about that in any organization. You know when the CEO is in the room. It is told to you. There's a civilian version of the Ten Hut that you see in the military, right? Like, we know when the senior manager comes in. But in this organization, in this meeting, the CEO, I'm sure she knew who the patient was. She knows who her patients are. It's not that big of an organization. They have like 200 staff. But she didn't know them that well. The person who did the cooking and cleaning in that residential facility, that person knew those people because that person spends more time with them. So that person led the meeting. And that person didn't make all the decisions. If there's going to be some speech therapy going on, the speech therapist is going to make that decision. But they're going to check with this person because that person knows the most. That's what a flexible hierarchy. That's what a fluid hierarchy is. But in order to do that, just in case you didn't get this, you have to know what drives the success of your organization. And it's not just implementing your strategy. Like, implementing a strategy, in their case, would be providing the best healthcare, the best speech therapist, the best, occupational therapy. Doing the work the best, that'll give you the results. They know, however, that it's not that simple. If you're rebuilding a shattered life, you have to do it differently. You have to connect deeply to that person. And then that's what drives the flexibility inside of the organization. My argument is that most organizations don't take the time that they took to figure out what drives their success. And when you do, that's how you can build this in. But if you don't do it, you're going to be guessing on how to become a fluid hierarchy, and it's not going to be as effective. Okay, and the last one is fast. And this is a capacity I think that everyone wants. Like, everyone wants to be a fast organization. Who wouldn't? But this one... it's not just about like incremental improvements in efficiency. This is about leap ahead kind of speed. We don't do a case study on them, but there's a small company called Back to the Roots that they're a startup, so they're kind of nimble anyway. But they manage, they had a couple of products that they sell through, they're consumer products, but they sell them through like Home Depot and Whole Foods and stuff. One of them is about growing mushrooms using used coffee grounds. It's an interesting group. Anyway, they had these products, pretty successful, maybe $4 million in revenue. They were growing maybe 10 or 15 staff. And they got a meeting with the number one purchaser at Home Depot. And the guy's like, hey, I want to come meet with you in your office. I'd like to hear what you have in the pipeline. I want to know what future products you're working on because these first two were good, but I want to see what's next. And I'll be there in 3 days. And they're like, no problem, we'll see you in 3 days. And they hang up the phone and they're like, hey, do we have anything in the pipeline? They're like, no, nothing. They had been focused on their current product so much, they had nothing in the pipeline. But they had no problem saying in 3 days we'll make a presentation to the number one purchaser at Home Depot. And the CEO turned to his staff and said, go. Use the internet, use the 3D modeling software that we've been using for our current products, use the tools at your disposal, and in 3 days I want you to come up with something that we can present to them. He had to let go of control in order to make this happen. And in order to let go of control, there's a quote from Mario Andretti, you know, the race car driver. He said, if everything appears to be under control, you're just not going fast enough. That's it. If you want that kind of speed, you've got to let go of control. But to let go of control, you have to be able to trust something in its place. Because you won't just let go of control by yourself. You've got to trust. This guy trusted in the internet, frankly, and the ability of his employees to use the internet and to use software. And they came up collectively with this presentation of new product ideas. And literally, the guy from Home Depot saw the presentation and said, wow, that was great. He said, why didn't you tell me about these ideas earlier? And I don't even know if they had the courage to say, because these ideas didn't exist 3 days ago. Okay? That's speed. That's the kind of fast I'm talking about. But you have to let go of control. The case study that we have, I love that our case study for this one's a bank. Okay, because I wouldn't expect a bank to be that fast. But there's a bank in Texas called Happy State Bank. They were formed in Happy, Texas, which is an actual town. It literally has a sign at the edge of town that says "The Town Without a Frown." I'm not making this up. But they are the 29th largest bank in Texas, which has some pretty big banks. And 20 years ago, they were 815. Okay, so they've grown a lot. They can open a branch in 4 days. They can go from thinking about opening a branch to serving customers in 4 days. And they give their loan decisions twice as fast as their competitors. Not just a little bit faster, but twice as fast. But they don't make bad loans either, so they're making good decisions. And they give up a lot of control, but what drives their ability to give up control is what they put their trust in, is relationships. They trust in the power of strong relationships, and they only hire people inside the organization that are good at making relationships, both internally with other staff people and externally in the community. And they design their systems around that. So they do not, for instance, have a call center. Like, they're a fairly large bank. You'd think they'd have a call center. You know, it's more efficient that way. No, when you call up, you are routed to someone in a branch that is the branch that you are going to go to if you ever go to a bank. And you will talk to them, and they will build a relationship with you, because then when you do show up in the bank, they're like, "Oh, Mr. Nodder, it's good to see you. I was on the phone with you the other day." And they use that as an opportunity to build a relationship. And they use these relationships. Like, they even said, if someone calls up and says, "Hey, I'm having trouble logging on to the online banking system." I talked to employees at the bank. They said, it is not uncommon that someone would hang up the phone, drive to that customer's house, and then help them get online. Like, they will use that and maybe fix the router while they're at it, right? Because that was the problem. But they'll use that to build relationships, which means when I, 3 years later, when I'm going to apply for a business loan, they know me so well. They read the application and they're like, "Okay, I know your business, Mr. Nodder. You should also include this information over here. You might want to include this data too, because I know that that's something that we've talked about." And I do, and I submit the loan application. I could send the same application to their competitor, and they'd ship it off to New York, and it would come back 2 weeks later saying, "We need more data, we need more information." And I could fill it in. And both loan applications would be approved or disapproved. That's not the point. They're faster because they give up some control. They let local people control. Their loan limits are much higher at the local level. And they base that giving up control on the trust they have that when you build strong relationships, you make better decisions as well. Okay? Now, this is another one where they had to build their entire organization around that concept. They have to hire people who are good at building relationships. By the way, all four of these case studies that I talked about, they all hire for culture first and they train on skills later. Menlo Innovations hires people who are good at collaborating. They don't really care what software languages you know or don't know, because they actually can't predict which ones they're going to need in 2 years anyway, so they're going to train you on that. They hire you on kindergarten skills. Can you collaborate? Because you're about to go share a computer with someone 5 days a week, so you'd better be good at collaboration. And we'll train you in the rest. Happy State Bank as well. If you are not good at building relationships, they're not going to hire you. And so I'm arguing, and we'll have some time for questions too, but I'm arguing that the future of business is digital, clear, fluid, and fast. I think these principles, these capacities inside organizations are going to give people a leg up. Organizations that embrace these ideas are going to start succeeding in noticeably higher ways than organizations that don't. But the only way that you really get this inside your organization is if you build it into your culture. You can't just bolt these on with new processes or new instructions to your employees. You've got to dig deep inside your organization and make it revolve around it. And so I would argue, although I think digital, clear, fluid, and fast are important, the number one thing you can do to make your organization more competitive is actually be more intentional about your culture and design it. Because most cultures are accidental. You backed into your culture. It's what your founder wanted it to be when they started the organization. It's maybe what the senior management wants it to be now, but they're not even articulating it beyond like the core values statement. Don't get me started on the core values statements. Like, really, integrity, honesty, quality. If I can guess what they are, then like, are they really that, do they really distinguish you as an organization? I want to give you quickly, because I want some time for questions, but when I say that we need to work on culture, the pushback I get is, well, culture is too squishy, it's too vague, I don't know how to define it, it's not, like, it's too hard to work on. So here's the definition. It fits on one slide, okay, so this is not that complicated. Culture is the collection, I left a couple words out, the collection of words, actions, thoughts, and stuff that clarify and reinforce what is truly valued inside an organization. It's not, I put valued with a D, not values with an S. It's not about your core values, it's about what do we really value here. Happy State Banks values strong relationships. They're really clear on that. All the other organizations, they're really clear on what's valued. Menlo, they value collaboration. If you can't do collaboration, you don't get to work here. When they hire people, they test them for collaboration, not software design. They'll test them a little bit on software design as well, but they start with collaboration. If you don't pass the collaboration test, we don't even get to see whether you can write good software. Okay? And you have to understand what inside your organization is really valued, and then your words, the descriptions you use for the culture, your behaviors, how you manage people, how you interact with other people in meetings, the underlying assumptions, and even how you design your organization. Most of these organizations that we looked at, they designed their workspace specifically to reinforce their cultural values. I mean, I can't, the number of organizations that put fun on their core values and then I visit their office and it's a sea of gray cubicles. Like, really? You're going to have fun and design your space like that? Either take fun off or change the space. But don't try and tell me that you're going to have that glaring inconsistency and not do anything about it. So get clear on what's valued and build your organization around it. I will also say, this is something that's missing in the conversation we're having about culture. A strong culture is one that aligns what is valued with what drives the success of the enterprise. So, like, I love that you want to value fun. That's great. But I want to see exactly why valuing fun is going to help your bottom line. And it can, actually. I'm not saying that there's no argument there. I'm saying you've got to spell it out for me. You've got to show me that what's valued drives the success of the enterprise. I mean, Menlo Innovation values collaboration because when they create better software by writing it in pairs. And they spend less time fixing bugs. And that is profitable for them. And so they value it because it drives their success. They don't value collaboration because it's cool. They value it because it's work. Even because it works. Even like Zappos. Everyone talks about Zappos and how decentralized they are. They let their call center employees make a lot of decisions. Right, you call someone on Zappos, that guy or gal on the other end of the phone, they decide whether to give you free shipping. They don't have to get approval. They can spend as much time on the phone with you as they want, which is not the best practice for call centers. But they don't do that because they think decentralization is cool. They do that because they decided strategically the only way they could succeed as an online retailer selling shoes online, which I still don't see how they do that, is if they provided amazing customer service. Like, that's their strategy. Their number one core value is we wow the customer. Not just good customer service, like you hang up the phone and you're like, wow, that was amazing. They want that. So if you want that, then you have to give the people who are talking to the customer the power. That's why they decentralize. They value decentralization because it drives their success. It gives wow customer service, and that's what they think has been driving them from, you know, into the billions of dollars in sales, okay? So you have to start making these connections when you start building your culture of saying, what do we value and why do we value it and how does that drive our success? Now, I argue that the base of your success moving forward is digital, clear, fluid, and fast. So if I were you, I would figure out in your culture, where are we on these things? You don't have to be, like, all the way to the right on this, but you need to know where you stand. How much is digital, clear, fluid, and fast embraced inside your organization? And then on top of that, you layer your strategic piece. Like, what's going to drive our strategy? What's going to drive our unique position? What's going to drive success given who we are in our context? You layer that on top of the base. And that's a culture that's really strong. That's a culture that gets results. That's the cultures that are in these case studies that I have. So that's what I got. What questions do you have for me? We have 5 minutes. Yes, go ahead.
You started at the beginning talking about social media. The social media with the millennials seems to change rather quickly.
Yes.
As far as what social media is important to them.
How do
you know what social media, like, you know, Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, or how do you know where to focus attention?
So, yeah, the short answer is folks like you and me with gray in the beard, when we start to like it, then we know they're not going to be there.
They're not going to be there.
As soon as you're like, this Facebook is actually pretty cool. Look, I'm connected to all my high school buddies. And then suddenly, poof, they're like, oh boy, the grown-ups got Facebook. We got to go somewhere else. Now, I mean, I'm a little flippant on that. And I think there are some really good, there's some big expensive social media monitoring tools where those companies are constantly figuring it out. I used to be more up on social media than I am now, but like Instagram has been growing a lot. And Instagram used to be just a place where you put your photos. But now people are sort of using it like Twitter. It's like, I don't want to just post a photo. I basically want to say something like I used to do on Twitter, but I'm going to say it with a picture. Yeah. Because definitely there's data that says images and videos are just more appealing. And so suddenly so you just have to watch that stuff, because that is going to go up and down. And I mean, we wrote a book called Humanize a few years ago. It was about how social media is changing the way we work. And I remember thinking, we wrote a chapter, and chapter two was about social media and the revolution and what's happening, and we're like, we cannot predict where this is going to go. And this was in 2011, we were writing the book. I'm like, right now, the hottest thing is Quora. Anybody know what Quora is? Yeah, no, it's not, because it didn't go anywhere. But in 2011, in the social media world, they were like, ooh, you ask a question and people answer it. It's sort of like crowdsourced stuff. Fine. And it still exists, but it's not that hot. Like, I don't know, and it's hard, and I don't think there's an algorithm for predicting. Social media is a practicing art. You can't figure it out ahead of time. You only figure it out by doing it. And so, to me, the best strategy is learn how to do all the social media so you're in it, and you'll get a sense of the patterns. But you have to expect that investing in any one channel, like you're going to get maybe a year or two out of it, and then it's going to. Not that it will. I mean, Twitter's still popular. But it's likely to shift down.
Yeah, doesn't last forever.
You can't count on that anymore. It's not that same kind of long-term thing. Other thoughts, questions? Yeah.
Before, when you were mentioning about two people working together on the same screen, or separate screens, but seeing the same thing.
Same screen. Anyway, go ahead.
Same screen. It makes me wonder what one would do if they were an introvert. And if these new ways of working are more geared towards the extrovert.
So I think in their case, specifically, that's a bit of a challenge. And I think there are a lot of software designers that would choose not to work there. I don't want to work that way. This is actually something that's really valuable about a culture, and a strong culture, is you say, here's our culture. If you want to work here, you got to like this. And it's okay if you don't like it. But then you don't get to work here. Okay? And if you get people in and they're like, yeah, I totally like this, and then when they're working on it, they realize, I really don't like this, then it's like, well, we got to find you a new job. I mean, that's one of my basic frustrations with the business world is we need to be much more comfortable with separation. We need to have more people quit, and we need to fire more people. Like, if we could do that, life would be better. And part of it is not every organization is a good fit for everybody. I think there are plenty of organizations, though, that design. I interviewed one for the book. There was a software company. They designed their office space based on the needs of the employee. And so, in a pretty radical way. So they have, like, their software, so they have a bunch of people working together, like in Menlo, where they're all on tables together and they're chatting and it's all very social. And they said, yeah, and then we have one other person, she gets her own office. She's not senior, she's not a director, she just likes to work in the dark. Like, she has her own office and the only lights there are Christmas lights. Like, because that works for her. right? And a lot of people are like, oh, but that's not fair. How come she gets an office? No, in this organization, their cultural principle is, we design space that works for you. This is how it is. And so that in that organization, you can be an introvert and a coder and a coder. So I don't think all of these, even clear, making things visible, and even these open office spaces, the people that are designing open office spaces are learning very quickly that you need private space. If you don't have privacy, that's a problem. And actually, at Surgery of the Hand, they work at home one day a week as well, where they get plenty of quiet time and private. There's actually a lot of quiet time and private space in that organization, even though their desks are together. They're just not always at their desks. So you have to build that. Part of designing around the individual is building in for different work styles and that issue. But again, not every organization. At Menlo, you don't take work home because you have to work in pairs. So you are constantly interacting with someone. If you can't handle that at work, then it's not going to work for you. Other questions? All right, well, I'm going to hang around today. I've actually got some books that we're going to sell on the show floor, starting whenever that is, 12-something, 12:30. And there's also, if you didn't see them, articles. I had an article on the millennials in the magazine, and there's copies back there for you to grab. And thank you guys for letting me play with you today.